others at Furman Institute for inviting me to participate in this very unusual conference. And so very pleased to be here. We don't have to argue, I think, about the fact that macroeconomic systems are extremely complicated. And it's not surprising that economists over the years have developed many strong simplifying assumptions in an attempt to model these systems. Okay? But the case I want to make today is that many of the recent advances in computational and mathematical tools that many in this room are familiar with are rendering obsolete the argument that these traditional simplifying assumptions are necessary for macro modeling. They might be desirable ultimately, but I don't anymore view them as necessary. That means they should be subject to testing as hypotheses rather than simply maintained without examination. So the case I want to make today is for one such tool, agent-based computational economics, which is the computational study of economic processes modeled as interacting systems. And I want to start by looking at the issue of why I believe macroeconomic systems are complex. And I, from the group meeting today, there seemed to be total agreement on these factors. But let me just put them out there for everybody to see as well here. I'd then like to give you an illustration, or I'd like to talk briefly about what is agent-based computational economics. And then in a more concrete setting, introduce why I think it has potential, at least, for modeling macroeconomic systems in a compelling way. And I'm going to end my talk today by making a plea for, as Eric said, a plea for the need for development of many different test bits, many open source test bits that can be agent-based modeling, can be other things, but test bits where we can do systematic experimentation on modeled macroeconomic systems. Okay, there are a lot of integrated tools available so that students, researchers, and others can actually test out new ideas and also can see how things work or don't work when they make changes in basic system features. So let me just start by the topic on, you know, what is it that causes macroeconomic systems to be complex? And the way I view it, and I think everybody here really does too, is that we have a system which is composed of a lot of interacting micro units. And the interactions among the micro units are very important for understanding irregularities that emerge, that we cannot actually explain these regularities on the basis of looking at a single representative agent, whether it's a single consumer or a single firm or a single trader. That we really need to look at the interactions among heterogeneous agents of many different types, and that we don't even know yet exactly what taxonomy of agents we're actually going to need to build models successfully that reproduce and help us to understand actual macroeconomic systems. We haven't even talked enough about, in economics I'm saying now, about the richness of the taxonomy that we really now can have in our models, and then the question is, should we? Okay, I view macroeconomic systems as the data generating mechanism for macroeconomic systems to be based on three key aspects that all must be present in order to have an adequate chance of understanding the systems in terms of cause and effect. And that's structural conditions, institutional arrangements, and behavioral dispositions. And structural conditions, of course, physical biological limits, et cetera, infrastructure, the transmission grid, for example, highway systems, institutional arrangements, you know, how do markets work? What are the rules? What are the regulations under which people are behaving in these systems? And then, of course, what degree of flexibility and characteristics do these behaviors exhibit when people are interacting within these frameworks? What is their stance toward risk? What about responsiveness to incentives? You know, what about their learning capabilities, and so forth and so on. So there's just a lot of different aspects, structural, institutional, and behavioral, that I really think we need to start building in better in our macroeconomic models.
Are these exogenously specified, or are they?
No, and the bottom line says structure, institutions, behavior can in turn evolve. Okay, so when you put it all together, you have these very complicated dynamic feedbacks. So that these three, that people have, you know, there's a macroeconomics, there's a microeconomics of macro, and there's a macroeconomics of micro. I mean, people's ideas of how the macro systems work affects how they behave at the micro level too. So there's this complicated feedback, and of course, they then turn around and can change. aspects of the institutional structure and their behaviors. And that's what I'll get to in a minute. Okay. So very, very complicated feedback. So the issue then for me.
Excuse me, but where is money and credit?
I'm not even at that level yet. I'll get there, but I'm not even at that level.
Credit's under institutional.
Institutional arrangements. I mean, if you want to put, I mean, it's part of the institutional arrangements. Money is a social contrivance. Okay, to use Samuelson's old term, right? I mean, it's a socially accepted means of payment. So I mean, basically, we have to agree to accept money. But let's, you know, I mean, I'm just saying, I would put that under institutions. Actually, I would, but you could argue about that later. Okay, I have to. Let's see. Okay, so can the agent-based approach help? Okay, so I mean, I'm going to argue that it can help, and that it's designed, in fact, for this degree of complexity. Agent-based modeling is actually designed to handle this degree of complexity. And ACE, as I said before, computational study of economic processes and dynamical systems of interacting agents. The goal, though, is the development of these empirically grounded dynamical economic theories, where we don't just presume equilibrium or other coordinating assumptions a priori, but rather we actually step back and ask the question, given the system built on realistically modeled or at least proposed institution structure and behavioral dispositions, does some kind of equilibrium actually emerge or arise? And if so, what form of equilibrium?
So do you mean that it's not empirically grounded or empirically verified?
Empirically grounded means to me both input empirical validation and output. That is, that I have to see if the assumptions make some sense. If I think I want to have a causal scientific understanding of a process, then the input has got to make sense empirically as well as the output. So, you know, in work we're doing, we're looking at business practices of actual companies and markets and building in the actual procedures and processes by which companies operate. And then on the output side, we hope to see the kind of price and output data that we actually see coming from the real world market. So I think it's a two-way street. Input empirical validation, output empirical validation are two aspects of two sides of the coin for me.
What makes me slightly uncomfortable about that is the way that a physicist comes about coming up with a theory is he has a guess about how it works, which has got some very significant logical consistency about it. And then what happens is we go back and check the data to see if it's consistent with what happened.
True, but you wouldn't build a theory, I don't think, that goes against the first principle of thermodynamics. And in other words, once you've got something that you trust as a principle.
Well, where did we get that?
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Let me try to bridge between you guys just very quickly. What you're saying, empirically grounded is a big word. You know, if you go back to Doyen's stack, you know, if you're up at the top, empirically grounded means you got a macro measure, very coarse-grained, that looked like some other macro measure, very coarse-grained that you saw. Well, empirically grounded down there at the bottom means you tested a theory way lower in the stack based on some empirical evidence, and then tried to see what happened as it went back up towards the top. This is looking for the space between the tunnels.
Let me just answer this the way I think of this myself in my own other work in power markets. When we build a transmission grid, we don't want to leave out the fact that power flows on the transmission grid according to Kirchhoff's laws. We don't want to leave off basic principles that we know model and channel the way power flows on a grid. So we want to build that in. So when I'm saying empirically valid, economists these days in power economics, many of them cannot or do not understand transmission grids, so they build two bus systems or three bus systems with no actual physical laws governing power flow. Those aren't very convincing to engineers. Just as if people build economic models without paying attention to actual business practices, you can go out to speak to actual business people, and they're not going to pay attention to you because they're going to see that you're missing key aspects of how they actually are constrained in their own behavior. So I think we have to pay attention to actual practices, actual, you know, what's out there in the real world to build compelling models that we can build artificial worlds. And that's fun, too. I mean, I'm not saying we can't do that, but I'm saying what I think we really need in macroeconomics right now is empirically grounded. So we go out there and talk to people who are actually dealing with these systems, you know, policymakers, people who are actually dealing in the front lines with these critical issues of macro, and they can see themselves in the model, and they can see that the constraints in the model make sense in accordance with what their real constraints are. So they start paying attention. Mm-hmm. You know, I want people to say to me, I care about what you get in your experiments. I want to get to the point where people say, you know what, I'm interested in what your experiments are going to give me. I'm interested in learning what you learn from your experiments. I'm at that point of I think I'm informed about something.
Lee, how would you distinguish your approach to being empirically grounded or ACE approach in general, as some other people doing, from the kind of calibration exercises that people do with ESG?
Yeah, let me get to the concrete example before I get to that part, okay. Because I think it'll be easier to answer right. This. You know, if we stay on slide three, I think we're going to be pretty high level, and I want to get to a concrete example. Better. Okay, so basically here's, I know that a lot of people here already understand age-based learning. Let me just sort of lay out my view of it, because it may not be exactly what everybody else agrees on, but I think of age-based modeling as permitting us to do culture dish type experiments, where, you know, like we have a Petri dish, which we fill with some kind of medium, and we are, you know, bacteria or whatever, that we're really interested in studying, how does that bacteria, develop in terms of this particular medium? And we close the Petri dish, put it aside, and then we do not disturb it anymore, we don't intervene, we watch what happens, because we really want to test the hypothesis that that initial medium will increase the growth rate of the bacterium by 10% or whatever. We have hypotheses, we really want to watch that. And so we build this little artificial world, and then we watch it develop, and we take observations on it, but we don't intervene. We're really testing whether the initial conditions that we set cause or cause to arise the kind of hypothesized consequence that we have proposed. So I'm thinking of agent-based modeling as really test bits. You know, permitting experimentation, computational experimentation, but they really permit us to develop theories, it's of course still theoretical at this point, develop theories about how certain types of institutional structures and behaviors will interact with each other to give us certain consequences. And the big thing we're looking at, in all the work I've done, the biggest thing that we see here is unintended consequences are the real problem. And test beds like this will help us, I think, better to see the full distribution of possible outcomes, including those tail events where we have unintended consequences that can be so disastrous, and that the standard or normal operation of economies is not going to permit you to have a lot of data on. Okay, so anyway, this is my vision of what we're talking about here, is that we're building artificial worlds where we build in, we have, of course, some reason for doing this. We have some purpose for doing this. We build in particular things with some hypothesis about how these things we build in are going to behave. And then we can actually examine through these test beds, you know, what actually arises. Now, what are agents? You know, to me, I'm very much oriented toward object-oriented programming, agent-oriented programming, where I think of an agent as an encapsulated bundle, as they call it, of data and methods, where the methods act on the data, and that we're talking about this agent as acting within some computationally constructed world. All right? And I'm thinking of agents here very broadly. We do use Java in our platform building for our test bits. And I'm really thinking of everything being encapsulated in the form of an agent, where agent is very broadly interpreted here to include, yes, individuals, but also social groupings, biological entities, physical entities. So everything, in some sense, is encapsulated or has these, as we were talking earlier in our group today, borders, if you will. That what are the persistent entities in the world that you're trying to capture in this model? It's a question of taxonomy. And of course, we have this great freedom to build this very elaborate taxonomy. The question now is not what we have to do here, what should we do for different purposes? In my mind. Okay. Cognitive agents, though, we're putting a lot of our attention in our testbed development into cognitive agent, because we're very interested in particularly in decision making under uncertainty, particularly again in the power market area. But cognitive agents, I'm here using Nick Jennings type categorization of the kind of properties that we think of an agent having to be called a cognitive agent, the behavioral the ability to adapt one's behavior to one's circumstances. Okay, the ability to adapt, to have internal structure that's adapting, okay, that something's happening inside in response to the external environment. Goal-directed learning, the ability to set or have anticipatory plans that you really direct your actions towards actually achieving something in the future. And the third one, I just want to pose something to you. What would the real world be like if nobody could actually talk with each other? What would the real world be like if we couldn't talk with each other? And then to realize that, to my knowledge, apart from the agent-based modeling that we're now doing, there are no economic models in which people talk with each other, except through very, very constrained message spaces, which basically are all concerned with passing price information. I know this because Leo Hurwitz was my advisor. He just got the Nobel Prize for his work on message spacing. So I'm familiar with that literature. But the type of messages that economists allow to be passed are extraordinarily narrow relative to what we actually do when we engage in social communication. And so this, just the fact that agent-based modeling permits, with a very simple address book and a pointer, we don't have pointers in Java, but we just dot to the identity of the other agent, we can just pass messages adaptively scripted, adapted to your environment, on runtime constructed. We have ability to communicate. This is revolutionary, that we can now build models in which people talk with each other. And yet, we're still at the very beginning. We don't even know what this is going to do, when people can actually talk with each other in the model, endogenously, in adaptive ways. Okay, so that's just one. Okay, endogenous formation of interaction networks. In our work on labor markets, the workers can make offers to employers who can fire or hire or refuse their offers. There's a back and forth chatter going on. They can be fired for cause on the work site. So the network of who ends up interacting with whom and how regularly is entirely formed endogenously by what happens on the work site and how the workers and employers react to that event on the work site and whether they feel like they should go out and look for a job elsewhere or stay where they are. It's all very endogenous. So interaction networks and social systems are not fixed links. They are part and parcel of the adaptive nature of economic systems that we have to think about how they form and when they persist, and when they do persist, at what cost? Because it's costly to maintain network links. Okay? And then perhaps the biggest one of all is this autonomy. The encapsulation into agents of data and methods allows, as part of that encapsulation, the designation of certain data and methods as private, which means that no other agents can have access to those data and methods directly, but only with the permission of the agent. And that means, in fact, that there can be parts of these agents actually evolving over time, okay, that no other agent can see, and that allows social construction of personality, deception, okay, and unpredictability. Because if an agent cannot see into another agent and understand the methods they're using, okay, then that agent becomes, at least in part, unpredictable to the other agents. And that, I think that's very realistic, that we don't reveal our entire selves to other people. We have private aspects to our lives. And this is very important in terms of deciding how strategic interaction and behavioral uncertainty affects market and other types of economic process. So autonomy, the ability to self-activate yourself and self-determine when you're going to talk with somebody, when you're going to make an offer, what offer you're going to make, and then to evolve, to learn and think and evolve along your own thread, okay, means that we're really beginning to be able to model interactive systems with I wouldn't say fully autonomous, I'm not a, I'm not about to say that, but with more autonomous agents than we've ever seen in social modeling before. To me, this is just revolutionary. We've hardly begun to exploit what this means for doing social modeling to have agents be autonomous interactors within these systems. Okay, so anyway, importance of agent encapsulation, I think I just said it, is a real world economy consists of distributed entities with limited input. So in the real world, anytime a process is enacted, anytime a computation is done, anytime a cost or utility function is or utility is evaluated, somebody is doing that evaluation. And that means cost in terms of time and effort and resources. There's some actual real-world cost to carrying out every process. And ACE forces adherence to that constraint, because when you have every single method in the model encapsulated into some agent, then carrying out that process is only going to be able to be done by that agent in which it's encapsulated according to that agent's own resources, beliefs, learning method, whatever it has available. But it means that we cannot, at this point, with a full agent-based model, we cannot then, as outside modelers, be coming into the model and imposing coordination from the outside. You're saying, let markets clear, let expectations be correct, let people have perfect foresight. All these things that we're used to doing in economics, where we're standing outside any actual agency in the world, and we're imposing these things on the world. Agent-based modeling no longer permits that. And I think that also will cause a completely different kind of modeling where everything has to come from agency within the modeled world. You know, cannot come from outside the modeler's perception of how coordination should occur. And what that's going to allow us to do is to test for equilibrium rather than to just assume it. Okay, so anyway, four main strands of ACE research, a very active bunch of different areas that I keep track on. I have an ACE website where I have a variety of pointers to a lot of different work. But the one I want to point to today, I promised Barclay, I'm going to get concrete. I want to just talk about a concrete illustration of theory, of application of ACE to the theory generation problem of a very simple nature. And for some of you, it's going to be really too simple. For others, it may be new. So let's just think about this. This is an exercise I actually give to my macro class every fall. I ask them, they are master students in macro theory. And one of the exercises I ask them is choose an article of your, any article you wish that is a standard economic journal, good quality journal, and has the usual approach to economics, which is to say, it's generally based on Arrow, DeBruyn, McKenzie, or Walrasian equilibrium, where there's some kind of competitive model with prices taken as given, and then markets are assumed to clear, and all that kind of thing. Okay, and I ask them, I say, okay, take that model, remove every single part of the model that is representing an equilibrium assumption imposed from the outside rather than coming from within the agency itself. Okay, so remove all, construct this agent-based testbed that qualitatively captures it. I'm sorry, I'm not on the right slide. I was talking to you. All right, so this is the issue, okay, that I want to get at. What are the performance capabilities of slice market economies? But the actual experiment, I'm sorry, that I started to talk about is here, where we take this standard journal article or this standard study, remove all imposed equilibrium conditions, including market clearing, correct expectations, and try to replace that, those removed conditions, with agent-driven processes for trade and production and so forth, sufficient minimally at least to reestablish a circular flow that is a sustainable economic system where consumers and firms are interacting with each other. Okay? Analyze the resulting economy to see if and when it is able to attain some form of equilibrium state over time. So this is the exercise, the general one I pose, and I'd like to pose it here in the same sort of way. So here's an example. Okay, a very standard format for Arrow, DeBruyn, McKenzie, or Walrasian equilibrium. Walrasian is the forerunner. Arrow, DeBruyn, McKenzie basically revved up the model with a lot of existence proofs and so forth and generalizations. But Walras, his basic conception is what's behind Arrow, DeBruyn, McKenzie. And it was this. You've got a bunch of consumers. You've got a bunch of firms. The firms can be heterogeneous. The consumers can be heterogeneous. So we cannot, it's true, we cannot charge the traditional Walrasian model with not treating heterogeneous agents because it does. It does. Okay. But here's how it does it. Because of the complicated nature of the problem, you want to say the question that's posed by Walras was, does there exist a price system or price vector that is capable of supporting an allocation among consumers and firms in such a way that all markets clear? It was a logical question for which the answer was not clear when he posed it. And the existence proof was not proved until later, by Arrow, DeBruyn and so forth. Okay? So here's then the basic setup that he had, that Walras had. He has firms producing goods here just potato, hash potatoes and beans, has a bunch of consumers who want to consume beans and hash. He then has an artificial construction in the middle that Axel Leonathan calls the Walrasian auctioneer. It's really a clearinghouse. And here's how it kind of works. The fictitious clearinghouse posts prices to everybody, posts prices for beans to the bean firms, posts prices for hash to the hash firms, post prices for beans and hash both to the consumers. Also, these are supposed to be corporations, so there's some stock ownership, so there's also some dividends. So basically, the Walrasian auctioneer also posts proposed dividends for the consumers. Based on these given prices, and for the consumers also the given dividends, the consumers, each one individually, goes into a corner and solves a utility maximization problem subject to a budget constraint, taking those given prices and dividends. And once they take as given those prices and dividends, it's just a simple little optimization problem. They don't have to know anybody else exists. They don't interact with anybody. All they have to do is get that price and dividend information and then just determine on the basis of that what is their demand for beans and hash, conditional on those prices and dividends. And the firms do the same thing. They take their price. Each one gets a price. For bean firm gets a bean price, and the hash firm gets a hash price. Each firm goes into a corner, okay, solves a simple little firm optimization problem. What? Oh, wow. Oh, I had no idea. I thought you were, oh, my goodness. Okay, all right. I'll go much faster. Okay, anyway. The point is, okay, the point is, I'll go much faster. I thought I was talking very fast. Okay, that's amazing. I only have 30 slides. I'm only on 12. All right, anyway. It's amazing. Anyway, once these prices are all posted to everybody in dividends, okay, they all do their individual optimization, and then they give back their demand and supply to the auctioneer. And the auctioneer looks at them and they says, is supply at least as great as demand in every market? If it is, got an equilibrium, that's fine. If not, the auctioneer reposts prices again, and this is called a tautomo process, where you keep going and going and going until finally the auctioneer posts some prices, for which indeed the returned responses, demand and supply response functions, are such that all markets clear. Okay, that's the actual underlying mechanism of Aero de Brew. Okay, even though they have in more modern terms, they use expectations instead of an auctioneer giving posted prices. But the exercise then is to remove those connections that rely on the fictitious auctioneer. And what's left? And I'd argue that the traditional Aero de Brew model has nothing left to connect the agents with each other at all. But it's all done through the fictitious auctioneer. And so then the exercise becomes, okay, how would you reconnect consumers and firms using actual agent-driven trade, production, and settlement processes? What would you do? How would you do it? Okay? Attention is going to have to shift from this previous format where you had maximization of profits and utility and social isolation, nobody actually talking with each other, or even knowing that they existed, that no one actually knows anyone else actually exists in the market. They're doing that profit and utility maximization in isolation, conditional on given publicly known prices or correctly expected prices. We now have to shift to having focus on trade interaction patterns among profit-seeking firms and utility-seeking consumers who recognize trade is essential for survival as well as prosperity. And here's the important connection with work to come. Have individual endowments and good-for-good reservation prices. So each individual agent has their own localized reservation prices, which we in economics typically interpret as marginal rates of substitution or technical substitution that constrain their trades. Okay. So I didn't realize I was running out of time. So anyway, I have a couple more slides, and I say, well, what exactly do we have to worry about? I'm going to end, I think, with the next just bunch of slides. This is an important point I want to get across. We certainly have to worry about, if we're going to try to complete the model as an agent-based, constructive, persistent economy, we have to complete the model by paying attention, careful attention, to the way markets are organized. This is not part of Aero de Brew. We have to say who is trading with whom and how often, and under what types of rules and regulations does trading take place. Why? Because without this, we don't know how prices are even going to form. We can have different kinds of markets. We can have bilateral. We can have trade mediated by brokers and dealers, for example. We can have different kinds of auctions. Each kind of market process leads to its own kind of pricing determination. So it answers the question, how can prices come to be determined? Consumers could be directly contracting in bilateral contracts with firms, producers. That's not very usual, but some large consumers may do that, okay, but that's not the usual case. Generally speaking, consumers deal with intermediate retail stores they don't interact directly with producers. They deal through retail stores of various kinds. That in itself entails a very specific kind of pricing mechanism where the retail stores post prices as dealers and try to make their money on the difference between the bid and the ask spread between what they get from the producers and what they're actually getting from the consumers. And the third example would be where the producers have retail outlets directly under their control, and they form auctions. Many seller posted auctions, and that's a different kind of market mechanism for determining prices. The outcomes were very different. The point is that markets emerge and evolve in economies. They aren't generally typically designed from top down, certainly not fully. And so we have to ask the question, why is it that different kinds of market forms have evolved for different kinds of goods? And the markets are heavily tailored toward the types of goods that are sold in them. So you cannot really divorce your concentration here. If you want to focus on price outcomes, you have to think about institutional structure evolving along with behavior to produce different kinds of price outcomes. And I was going to, since I'm almost out of time, I was just going to go on to talk more about how we actually constructed such a test bed with this kind of process for these auctions. Another important point here is that market making activities are absolutely critical here. You can't just assume the market exists. You have to talk about how the market is made. Let me just switch to the wrap up slide since you're not going to, since only I'm halfway through, but that's all right. So, anyway. Sure. Yeah, I just want to get to the bottom line here was the test bed, and I don't want to avoid that. So, let me just get that. Well, I should have just. Okay, so basically, I'm going to just conclude then with my wrap slide here, that I'm really recommending to this audience and to all economists, actually, that what we really could do usefully, I think, as a next step, is to develop test beds, agent-based test beds in particular, that permit the systematic testing of macroeconomic systems. And I would like them tailored, a whole bunch of them tailored to different specific issues. I would like them open source so that we can all replicate, see what's under the hood, you know, go into the code, see what people really did. We should be able to get model verification, findings should be replicated using multiple software and hardware platforms, and then also we need to bring theories to data for empirical validation in terms of the output validation side. So that's what I was going to conclude with. Anyway, wow, amazing. So I mean, the time went so fast. Anyway, thank you.
There was a lot of discussion, but I think as we ask questions, we'll come back to more.
Yeah, I hope so, since I have 15 more slides.
All right, who can guess what those 15 slides are and figure out the questions?
So let me put my earlier question in a slightly different form, but it's really the sort of maybe the more bottom line aspect of it. For people who didn't quite catch it, you run a central clearinghouse agent-based website, so you're on top of things that are going on.
Not fictitious stuff. Yeah.
No. She's very much on top of this going on. So I'm going to ask her, where is this at? In the sense that, okay, without naming names, we both know a number of people who are trying to do agent-based macro modeling. To get down to kind of a real policy bottom line, there is in fact what I hear a big struggle going on right now. Let's put it this way. What kind of models are going to be in the basement of central banks? Okay, what's been there has been the DSGE, Malraysian type models that you've sort of described, that have used calibration techniques for their empirical verification, which a lot of people have problems with, which is sort of my first question. From where you are at and from what you know, where do you think this struggle is at? Obviously, the recent crisis has increased the credibility of the agent-based approach.
The interest, yes.
And certainly the interest. Yeah. Where are things at? Are there major central banks? I've heard Bank of England.
Yes,
what the heck is going on out there? Is the battle over the kinds of empirical tests that ACE models do versus the sort of calibration jump that the DSGE? Where are things at?
Okay, well, you may be surprised.
That's the question mark.
If you look at the Wikipedia, okay, you might be surprised. If you look under macroeconomics, because I was surprised. Because I have a point of view, I cannot put things on Wikipedia under agent-based model. I can't do it because I'm point of view. Okay, But when you look at macroeconomics on Wikipedia, they now put two different approaches, DSGE, dynamic stochastic general equilibrium, and agent-based modeling as the two. So that's very interesting to me that it's gotten that enough visibility that somebody out there, not me or anybody I know, has put these as parallel. I also think that the other advantage is going to be in the stress testing of institutional designs. I think that we see the absolute need for stress testing designs. We're seeing it going on with the banks. In power markets, we are doing the same thing for reliability and efficiency of power market systems. We're doing stress testing of designs. And I can see that eventually this might be an area where, as a complement to DSG, I'm not, you know, why get rid of tools? I'm for greater improvement. More tools, the better. I'm not trying to get rid of anybody's tools. I'm just saying for stress testing in the tail events, the standard models aren't even designed to do that. These are. Okay, so there's where I see a real advantage. And I see now a clear evidence that people understand the need to do institutional design stress testing and do it prior to implementation, if at all possible, before doing some kind of change with the institutions like they're currently considering. Why not have a systematic study? Or wouldn't it be nice to be able to have a systematic experimental study of what that change will do in terms of both intended and unintended consequences? So I think that's where we'll have an advantage in terms of trying to sell the tools, if we could build them. We would definitely have some application areas like that where clearly important application rate.
Yeah, so this is great. I have two questions which take it in a different direction. But I mean, it's absolutely convincing what you presented in that needs to be done. Apart from who's in which basement and policy issues, this is the issue of what's the right science, what's the best description, which derives macroeconomic regularities, laws if there are, lessons from a microeconomic model. And it seems to me there's a set of things, as a theorist, you might want to get out, and I'll mention two kinds of things. One is the kind of power laws that Doyne mentioned. And the other is something that hasn't been mentioned here, but for me, this is very influential work of Harold Morowitz on general work on reaction networks in driven far from equilibrium systems. And he did this in the originally thinking about the origin of life and chemical reaction networks, but it's a quite general result that if you have a network, and what you're doing can be reduced to a network, the agents are interacting with each other, they're passing things around. There's a hypothesis that the Wafarsian equilibrium is what people who do driven far from equilibrium systems would call a steady state of a far from equilibrium system. And a way to check that hypothesis is that features of one are found in the other. So for example, Morowitz proves the theorem that in a reaction network which is driven far from equilibrium, if there's a steady state, it's connected with the formulation with the formation of cycles.
Yeah, I read a little bit from your paper about this. I was going to ask you more about that. Yeah, I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah. So my question really is, in this test bed, are there models that you or other people have developed where you can go into and measure things like power law distribution and
income
power
law distribution? Yes, and I think Doyne knows a lot about that. I mean, the financial area is one of the hottest topics. And we have Blake LeBaron and others, Karis Hummus, who are really concentrating on trying to understand power law emergence, but not just power laws, because the important thing is that there's a whole set of anomalies. It's not just power, you know, the thick tails is one, but high volatility, you know, volatility clustering, correlation among returns that shouldn't be there under efficient markets. There's a whole collection of anomalies that we need, I think, to try to explain together, not just one at a time. And so what Karis Hummus and Blake LeBaron are trying to do is build interface models with enough compelling structure in them from financial markets. They have order books, you know, and they have long-term memory, heterogeneous memory traders and things like that. And then they're finding they can actually reproduce multiple anomalies at once. You know, I mean, combinations, not just thick tails, but combinations of these anomalies can now be explained together arising from these interaction models. So that's very encouraging, I think. It's one of the hottest. Power markets and financial are the two hot topic areas for agent-based modeling, I would say, right now. Not yet macro, unfortunately.
Please. These two.
Sorry. Oh, yes, Richie.
One of the problems with these models that people will criticize is that I could write out different kinds of agents and generate and structures and generate the same observable behavior.
Yeah.
You put a stress at the beginning, and I'm going to push on that, because you do have this choice.
Yeah.
And you'd like to obviously make a choice because you think it may matter for some new phenomenon you're going to predict that fits best with what we know about how people behave. How much work is there where before you were connecting with your agent-based model, you would say, gee, I'd like to run some economic experiments. Now, really, some of the people here don't know, but the experimental economics is going like hot fire.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to me sufficiently connected.
Okay, you've given me a wonderful softball. I can take it.
Sorry.
Because at the Economic Science Association this summer, which is the big experimental economics conference, I'm actually getting a keynote address called From Human Subject Experiments to Computational Agent Experiments and Everything in Between. That's my title of my talk. Okay? And I'm working with Dan Hauser a bit on this. Okay? And what we're going to really promulgate here is, why have just test beds with all computational agents? Why have experiments with all humans? Why not have ability to range the whole way from one to the other? Why are we? Because the way we're modeling the agents here, one of the confining or the constraining modeling principles here is that you should be able, in principle, to take every cognitive agent in these models and replace them with a person and just slow down the simulation so that the person can actually interact with the rest of the system. And why not just one? Why just one? Why not two or three or five? So really what we're talking about here, Dan and I, we're talking about really putting together a proposal, okay, to try to push this idea of building these frameworks that integrate people with computational agents from one range, the whole range, okay? I also wanted to get your point in about the empirical data, though. Can I just take a moment? Because earlier he said something about the need for, what are we going to do with these large data sets? For example, linked employer-employee data. We also have the ability to link in or stream in real-world data so that we're running these simulations with people and computational agents together, possibly, with real-world data being streamed in about order books or labor market, whatever kind of thing. And so we're going to actually be able to have these scenarios where we can really run or rerun history with a new set of agents, in effect. And I think this is also very challenging and extremely intriguing and potentially very useful to be able to do that as well. So data streaming of random numbers as well as regular data, that means you can have external, actual, random processes being used to flip coins. So the argument that you have deterministic systems goes out, goes overboard as well. So you've got data streaming, and you've also got real people you can put in. So we can merge these things better with real-world empirical content. That's what I was like. I don't even know where to start. I think Joy has hand up for you guys.
Well, just a simple question. I looked at the Wikipedia entry, and I'm just curious if you could elaborate a little more what kind of things people are doing with agent-based macroeconomic models.
Rob Axtell, for example, is now, I was just at George Mason 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, he's now running 30 million agents in his macro test beds, okay? But he's basically interested, I think he's still interested in firm distribution, emergence of firm distributions with power law questions about that. There are other people that are, myself, I've worked on labor markets to some extent, but that's been taken up quite handily by Richard Freeman's student, Michael Neugert, who's really gone great guns on that area, and he's got this wonderful, I think, wonderful work happening there in labor markets where he's really, and he's getting published. Nice to say, of course, I refereed something. But he's getting published in good journals, and so I think that's very encouraging. We have John Duffy doing work combining parallel human subject and ACE experiments and stressing financial and social network interaction formation. So we, a lot of different people are beginning to have some success. And you actually mentioned just for macro, though. Okay, so I think Kars Holmes and all the financial people, Kars and Thomas Lux, have had a lot of success, right? So they are now, of course, Kars is the editor of the Journal of Economic Control. So he's already a pretty famous guy. And so for him to do this work, I think, is a very good sign. And we just had
Italians, too.
Pardon me?
The Italians, too.
I just
didn't
hear you.
The Italians.
Oh, yeah. I've got Giorgio Faccioli. Yeah, I should mention Giorgio. And yes, thank you. Of course. We've got all the Dossi, Galagatti, a lot of interesting, yes, thank you, my goodness, okay, yes, on my macro website, yes, on my ACE macro website, their work is featured, and I don't know why I should have forgotten it momentarily, but basically they're also very strong pushing forward with empirically based. Giorgio was a statistician, econometrician, so he has a lot of training there. So their work, I think, is also very impressive. And Herb Gintis had a paper come out in Economic Journal. It was very intriguing. And I think, actually, we should, that you're going to really like that paper because it's all about private versus public pricing, right? And it's extremely connected to your idea of using these W matrices. So, yeah, so I think there is some interesting work. It's scattered. That's why I try to put the website together on ACE research area of macroeconomics. I try to bring it all together and have as much of it there in one place for people to see. But I think it's beginning to come together. Okay, but there still aren't open source test beds. There's still people who are doing this work are still not producing frameworks that they then give out publicly so people can replicate their work. That's the problem to me, that there's no replicability yet of these experiments because the frameworks aren't open to people. Yeah.
So I wonder if there's a way.
I'm sorry, but the guy back there has had his hand up for a long time.
Only remind that you seem to me not a strategic, a good decision to press relevance to this kind of models, because in my view, what the critics could be is on the complexity of the model for the agents in this sense, no, or not on the general strategy, because this is, in my view, this is connected with the spin glasses approach on complex system approach, which in some moment should be the kind of relevance for analyzing this kind of things.
I don't know a lot about spin glass, but I think the difference I would say here perhaps is the degree of heterogeneity in the agents taxonomy.
No, the Giorgio Parisi and Rome University and Diego Gasolo, and there is a line of physics which is also connected with econom physics. Which the people are using this general framework.
Yeah, I'm familiar with econom physics, but I don't know enough about spin glass to actually comment. But my understanding is that the basic physics models were not built on the degree of heterogeneity and, of course, cognitive reactive behavior.
See, the limitations are only in the complexity of the model. See, yeah. The new insights you come in the how you make a good model of the agents. Being able to detect these kind of things happening in the crisis and those, these kind of things, you know, is a proof because they are not special. It's not a proof.
I there's just so much I'd like to be doing, but there's so little time. I'd like to know more about that literature.
I don't know
who is next, but there's comments. Okay. Sorry. Yes.
I had a question about empirical validation. So it seems like Vernon Smith and these guys have been doing pretty simple auction type classroom experiments that could be directly compared to your simulations. And do you find that with very simple algorithms, the agents more or less repeat what the students do, or is it more complicated?
It's like I'm planning your question, because one of his chief areas of interest is electricity experiments, and we've been very heavily using his experimental findings to motivate our computational test bed for power markets. So we've been looking at demand response, price sensitivity, retesting his ideas about market power under more generalized and realistic institutional arrangements. Now, a need that he had in his experiments is always to make things simple enough that people can understand them, that are participating in them, and that they can readily pick up the instructions and not make basic mistakes. And so, and then also they have to be short enough that the people don't get bored, and of course you also have to pay the people. And so there's a lot of reasons that human-centered experiments have some limitations that ACE can help. And on the other side of things, we can get helped from taking the data from those experiments and helping us to understand how to calibrate the agent's learning behavior. So that's what I'm saying for this work this summer with the ESA, that I really do feel it's a back and forth, and we want to pay attention to those experiments, but they're very short. The timeline is necessarily short. The institutional arrangements are necessarily simplified. They're typically run with students, or even if they are with participants, it's one sample. What we want to do is, just extend, build out and extend the degree of questions, or the range of questions we can ask, and the degree of institutional arrangements that we can build in
to the environmental setting. So it's a very two, it's a two-way street for sure.
Well, as a poor student, I actually participate in these experiments, so I'm very interested to know whether I could be replaced by a simple algorithm or not. So
yes,
it sounds like you don't know. Sounds like you don't know.
And the interesting thing is, can you be replaced by an algorithm that does better than you?
Well,
or even
which mimics me, because it doesn't.
Well, there's two things: mimics you, or the fact of the matter is, if you're a real trader in a real market, and somebody comes along and says, you know, I actually have an automated agent that relentlessly learns 24 hours of the day, and that I, you know, and then you've shown the person that this trader can actually extract more surplus than the human trader, I can guarantee you in the power market area that they're looking at automation of trading because of the complicated nature of that trading that they're forced to do in power markets every day. Three or four different kinds of markets they trade in. They're looking at replacing that with automation, with automated agents. So it turns out that the power market test bed we're building may someday not just be a representation of a power market, it may be the actual power market, you know, in the sense that we're building synthetic agents rather than representative agents. And so I think that's very interesting to think about, is whether a market can get so complicated that actually routinizing and automating parts of the decision making can actually help in some sense. So that's not, that's Kephart, that's a, that's Jeff Kephart and Dave Cliff and Janet Bruton and stuff. And that, you know, that's a very controversial thing, but people are automating trading in a lot of these internet markets now to avoid the competition. I'm sorry, I don't know who's there.
So this sort of gets to a question that Dwayne asked yesterday that nobody didn't address. Is anybody using this to specify agents that may choose to not buy, but to hold cash? This gets to what Keynes knew that we'd forgotten.
I meant
money not as a means of payment. I meant money as an asset.
Yeah, it's for the first time I could go back to a slide and say, yes,
good.
I could go back to the slide and say the key thing we're finding in this test bed for the macro world is the profit allocation rule of firms. The profit allocation rule of firms is, what do firms do at the end of the period when they have gotten the profit outcome, the net earnings outcome, actually, okay? Allocation of profits means you can do three things. You've got positive earnings, you can retain earnings, or you can pay it out as dividend, or you can buy more capacity. If you have negative net earnings, then of course you have to do something like sell off capacity or use up your money resources, okay? The way the firms end up deciding to hold retained earnings rather than to invest in more capacity or dividends turns out to be, in this dynamics here, turns out to be utterly critical to the dynamics of the market. And I have to say, I've never seen a macro model that addresses this at all in terms of dynamic choice. You know, what should the firm do at the end of each period in a learning adaptive sense? I've seen pre-imposed dividend payouts or something like that, but I really haven't seen people pay attention to what turns out to be an extremely important aspect of firm behavior, not just, you know, what price I set for my product and not just how much I produce, but what do I do with my actual earnings if I'm a corporation with fiduciary responsibility to my shareholders?
Well, we're also finding out right now that how consumers manage their balance sheets actually.
That's fine. That's Michigan. Okay. I mean, we know that state of balance sheets, both in firms and households, is extremely critical for decision making. This goes back to wealth, you know, introducing wealth into consumption functions and so forth. We know that really seems to have a big part to play, and that the housing crash and the stock market crash at the same time is destroying a lot of wealth means it's going to change decision making by these agents, no doubt. And we can test that more carefully in these test bits. But the economists are aware of these things, honestly.
Well, but Wynne Godley, who's been the guy who's gotten a little bit of visibility because the FT picked up on him, has really been kind of a prophet without honor in actually looking at sectoral cash flows and sectoral balance sheets and leverage as a fundamental driver.
I was
going to
say, accounting theory, absolutely
critical.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, it really is. You know, it's like the skeleton on which the flesh is hung. And unless we get the accounting right and the way people make use of these basic accounting identities, even, you know, that they aren't always properly modeled. Okay, and it just seems to me that they provide so much structure, so much constraint and channeling of behavior, that to get that accounting right, so I've been paying a lot of attention to that in my modeling, in both power and macro. So, yeah.
Just a short clarifying question. The market making, is that part of the methods of the agent, firm, and consumer?
Yes, it all has to be agency. That's why,
So they have multiple methods available and choose within the model which one to use?
Okay. In this, I believe that we ultimately have to look at the way people evolve their methods. Okay, that, you know, that if I look at a picture of an agent, okay, if I look at a picture of a cognitive agent, let me actually do that instead of showing you this table. Let me look at one of my firms. Okay, this is the way we actually model the firm. This is an encapsulated firm agent. Okay, and I've got a bunch of methods in here. At any given time, an agent's state is defined by his data and methods. But among the methods that the agent has are methods for changing methods. And this is, I put this as plasticity. You know, here is where we have perhaps even too much degree of freedom, because we can actually evolve every single aspect of that agent inside that agent. We can actually evolve every single method he has. If we wish, we could put a learning algorithm on everything, so he's actually testing and changing everything. How plastic are real-world firms? How plastic are real-world households and the way they behave? You know, I don't think we really know the answer to that yet. You know, where do people have a core of sort of persistent behaviors, and where are they willing to change and evolve their behaviors? The point is, the methodology of agent-based modeling permits a great deal of plasticity, probably a lot more than we really want relative to the real world. Okay, so I don't know the answer yet to how plastic these firms would want to be, but I know that right now I have them evolving their supply offers every day. In the morning, they're going up and posting prices and production amounts, and they're learning, because either they don't sell all they produced or they do, and they see the queue line of the consumers in front of them, you know, they can learn to make a different offer the next day, and they do.
It seems to me that you then have still imposed a particular kind of market, in the sense that I make a price offer, like a first price auction. And so we know that the allocation and the prices are extremely sensitive to the game form of the interaction.
That's exactly right. We do know from both human centered experiments and analytical work, as well as computation, that the nitty gritty design features of an auction can have a tremendous impact on the outcomes of auctions, and therefore details matter. And it's not just that our models are sensitive to these details, and so that's a flaw. We're actually, I think, capturing something that's true of the real world, that details matter, and what's more, people who design auctions or who participate in auctions very well know that. And so the very first thing you want to do, if you hear the government is setting up an auction for carbon cap and trade, or for treasury bills, or whatever it is, you want to be on the ground floor making the rules for that auction, because who gets what surplus out of that auction, who gets profits, is very much affected by the tiny details of the pricing, initial allocation of rights, carbon trading, and so forth. So, you know, we know that all that's true, and we can test it, I think, a little bit better with these models.
Could you put the trade as part of an agent? In other words,
It is part. It's a methods for
a separate agent, sort of a.
I've got a market agent. He's separated.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, market agents are separated. There's structural agents.
And
there's institutional agents.
Right.
There are cognitive agents. Okay, I'm sure people can think of other categories. But the market here is the way I've done it. The market is preset, so I'm not starting from nothing. I have a preset auction market with rules and regulations for bidding and offering into the market. And that strongly channels the behavior of the participants. I think I've got, am I out of time? Is that what this
is? No.
I thought I was being pushed out of the room.
Actually, just a technical question. Yeah. So this is achieved through MetaClass programming?
Java, just a Java class.
But in the methods that update methods.
Oh, that's the method I have that updates method right now is reinforcement learning, stochastic reinforcement learning. I'm using, and in other contexts I've used genetic algorithm, individual learning, GAs, and we use Q learning. But right now we're using a simple form of reactive stochastic reinforcement.
And the other question I wanted to ask was, if you think about biology. molecular biology had this brilliant insight to find the nematode as this thousand-celled worm with a 300-neuron brain with simple, simple behaviors.
Yeah.
Is there a search for the nematode, simplest rich system?
You mean like bankers or something?
We found a more primitive system. It's called an investment bank.
In some sense, the most trivial possible system that is almost that exhibits the behavior that's rich enough. I guess what's motivating this question in part is not knowing how these agent-based models will separate observable behavior into specious behavior and valid behavior, given what they are trying to model. Can you achieve this by getting to a simple enough system that you can actually sort of peer in?
Let me try to approach that a little indirectly. People here are familiar with the work of John Holland?
Okay.
So you know that you know, in these models, we can separate genotype and phenotype. So we can really have an underlying true sexual reproduction if we want. We could really have birth and death. And I think I mentioned a little bit that we have models in macro that do have birth and death, but they're not done on agent-based modeling yet. But we really could separate the idea of true evolution through heredity from phenotypic change through behavioral modification during a lifetime. And we can have those two running together. And there's just so much to do. I don't think in economics we've done a whole lot of that, but in the adaptive mind and other topics that have come up in artificial life, there are certainly people who are creating models in which they try to have the phenotype and genotype structure there.
Yeah, I wasn't actually talking about the agent as the worm. I was trying to think about the test bed as analogous to the
nematode. To a nematode.
Yeah. In other words, the simplest possible test bed that really allows you to almost fit this.
I think that's what we need to discuss, because I think that's what we would like, is sort of some building blocks that other people could then extend out. You know, people can have all their individual ideas of what to do. Let's give them some building blocks that they can start from. I think that would be great. Yeah, there might be more than one. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. So this is following up a question there. One of the things that physicists have intuition for, and I'm very ready to be told that the intuition doesn't apply here, but let me say it, is that complex systems evolve to phases when you go to macroscopic limits, mm-hmm. where only a few of the many, many parameters, many, many choices turn out to be relevant. So, and the thing that we're interested in is, or a way that we like to think is, which, you know, if you start to write, if you, in the answer to the last question, there can be lots of different parameters that tune how the agents make decisions, the kind of trading system, et cetera. If you come to a steady state, which is characterized by power laws. Again, this is an intuition. The steady state is characterized by power laws because there's a kind of scale invariance. That's what a power law means, mm-hmm. which wipes away information and wipes away memory. And the number of parameters that are relevant for things like what's the coefficient of the power law is a much smaller set than the total number of parameters in the micro model.
Yeah.
And we're interested in we call them relevant parameters versus irrelevant parameters. Mm-hmm. And we think we understand the kind of physical system, or we think we've made progress when we understand which are relevant parameters and which are irrelevant parameters.
I'm gonna agree certainly with the objective, but what I worry about from experiments that I've run is that I've done work with iterated prisoner's dilemma with choice and refusal of partners, and what we see there is you can get into quasi-stable states in which everybody seems to be cooperating fine. And so the important parameters seem to be just these few observable things that people are doing, and everybody's doing fine. Underneath, there's always mutation and recombination going on. And so that eventually there's genetic drift, if you will, in the strategies where they lose their ability to protect themselves against incoming more aggressive strategies, and then suddenly you're going along like this. It looks chaotic, you know, it's almost like the chaos phenomenon. You're going along like this, and then suddenly you'll do what we call tunneling from one equilibrium to another, because a mutant will come in, or a couple of them will come in, and exploit the genetic drift, and the lack of protection then of the current strategies from protecting against certain incomes. What I'm trying to say is it changes, you know, what's important or relevant in terms of the parameters. When you have a perturbation, all bets are off.
Absolutely, okay. But it sounds like, let me just say back to you what you said, because that there are phases, there are stable phases,
yeah.
There are metastable phases. In the metastable phases, only a few parameters are relevant.
Right.
It may be that those parameters differ from phase to phase.
Yeah.
You didn't say that, but that's what we would expect.
And I'm talking about is tunneling between.
Yeah. And if you then study perturbations, stability, there can be tunneling, and the irrelevant parameters are going to become important for the events that initiate phase transitions, initiate tunneling.
But the point I'm trying to make is that the tunneling is occurring because people are trying to tunnel. You know, people are trying to disrupt to create profit off this. It's really a Schumpeterian idea. You know, people are always trying to come in and upset the apple cart to create more profit opportunity for themselves.
Right.
So it's not as if you've got a predictable, even a Poissonian type of perturbation. It's this constant seeking of creating profit opportunity in all that.
Very good. Okay. So that point is very well taken.
I don't have any idea.
How does this scale? I mean, you've implemented this. How big is your universe? How many firms do you create?
Okay.
How many consumers?
I can't. Okay, this test bed is in development. My power market test bed has. Up to, you know, we have, we're aiming for the same thing here. I mean, we don't have any upper limit on the code, but what we will have, of course, in practice is on any platform we're on, we'll have memory limitations and speed of running experiment limitations. And so I don't think the code itself is limiting you in terms of how many, but I think in practice to run intensive experiments with we're running heat map type experiments with intensive parameter sweeps. There we need to have, we want to keep it small. In power markets, we're learning that we need about up to 30 buses to really capture, or we think we'll need about 30 buses to capture all the effects we care about. I don't know what the scale is going to be here. For a macro system, how large does it have to be before scale effects are
well,
no longer?
Sort of
yeah, I mean, you know, what, do you have to have 500 agents, you know, 1,000, 700, you know, where is it? I don't know. We have to test what, where scale effects matter, and maybe they matter all the way up.
Could you say what you're trying to do in this? When you say
okay, in this test bed, we're simply trying to complete the circular flow in the simplest way possible with a test bed that has consumers, hash firms, and bean firms, and I'm trying to do it for my class, my students, and we simply are putting in very simple methods right now for choosing for the firms to choose their production and prices each morning, and for how they allocate profits based on what they've seen in terms of their excess demands at night, and their profit situation at night. So we're trying to do a very simple first step away from while raising equilibrium, where we remove the equilibrium constraints, and we just want to complete the circular flow in the simplest way possible, so that the thing sustains itself. That's our goal here. So we're not, this is a toy model compared to the power markets where we're really trying to match the actual U.S. restructured power market framework. So
Brownie had his hand up, but let me just say, if there's anybody else after Brownie who hasn't had a chance to ask Lee, why don't we get those, and otherwise maybe we continue to interrogate over coffee.
Yeah. Okay, sure. That's fine.
Well, this isn't exactly as much a question as an observation. I'll return to the open source problem. For part of this stuff that I've been involved with for the last 15 years, this is a very old question. You know, there was a question, there was Swarm, there were other platforms, there are guys doing it in Java, there are guys doing it in C#, there's guys doing it in this, there's guys doing it that, there's guys doing all this other stuff. Each time one of these things starts, it zooms up a vertical stack aimed at a specific problem. So you've got biology versions, you've got a special version in the NSA for security spy stuff. You've got this, you've got that, you basically have a software state that's chaotic, and the layers that are common across all have not been identified and specified and made widely available. So that. And the verticalities that need to be aimed more vertically have not been very well defined or dealt with, so there aren't good specific applications on top of a general modeling base that allow you to specific things. I had tried back in the late 90s to see whether some of this could be brought together in an orderly way.
That was a bad, that's a bad time. We were looking again. My students are looking again.
I want to finish what I tried.
Oh, sorry.
I went out, then when that didn't work, I went out to Microsoft with a bunch of guys from the University of Washington and pled with them to build some realistic tools so this thing could scale, and they didn't think the market was big enough. And last spring we had a smaller conference, most specifically on agent modeling, and I asked Paul Moritz to come, who Bill can testify as the kind of individual that would understand this problem clearly, and we had a good discussion about it. And you guys basically have two paths that you can take and a problem. The two paths are, we can figure out the market is big enough, somebody will do it commercially, they'll make a few bucks on doing this, and it won't exactly be open source. The other possibility is somebody could get some not-for-profit funding, and you could do something open source and begin to build a robust toolkit. I'm not talking about the agent modeling as a tool to do a scientific problem. I'm talking about a tool to build a tool to do a scientific problem. And this, I think, in terms of this just like catching on, it's a little the answer to your question of what's in the basement. Who knows, really? That this would be one of the most important initiatives that could be undertaken in this field at this time that would allow it to really scale into the
point is we're building interfaces. But for example, in IT, where we're now interfacing with PNNL's C++ GridLab D, where we have a Java program we're interfacing across through new software that's been developed for interfaces. So I hope that'll help at least a little bit.
I hope it does too. So I'll finish with a problem from the view of an old software guy. What you got here is you've got all the bottoms-up guys who need a top-down solution to the bottom layer of the bottoms-up tool, which is a little bit like trying to get 20 house cats to march in step in the Easter parade. but it is a problem, and it would be a good initiative or project for somebody on the system side to undertake. I do believe that this, I go to these meetings all the time, and every time I meet, somebody else is trying their own way, and the first nine steps of the problem were to solve how to get to where they could start to work on what was at issue for them. So that means the loop back from good results gets completely trapped in a pipe.
Yeah.
And you know, if they get partway up and they need to go right over a half a pipe, they don't have a tools architecture
I
that shortens the feedback loop.
Yeah.
So anyway, maybe we can, you'll see a bunch more models, maybe at the end we can talk about.
So this is the question I was actually going to pose here. The conversation with Sasha at lunchtime. there's a very strong possibility in my mind, because I've been looking at this for a long time, that the tool set, in a very, very generic way, so that you're dealing with with agent-based models, with a formal language to describe the rules, you're dealing with things that can visualize what they're doing, such as heat mapping and descriptions and so on. And there's only a small thin layer at the top that's needed to specialize that
right
for a particular discipline, whether it's biology, or whether it's economics, or whether in my case, it's distributed computing systems.
You know about the agent-based toolkits, right? I'm sure.
I used to mess around with a lot.
Yeah, Repass, Mason, and so forth. Yeah, but
they're very limited.
Yeah, they are. What we basically found is that they've turned into Cheshire Cat smiles in our
yes.
program, because we've just gone up and around them with the Java API. But I really think this interfacing idea is catching on a lot. That, you know, people are designing these things where you can actually go back, you can call in stuff from a C++ program into a Java program. You can interact with MATLAB or C.
The principal reason it's taken a decade and a half for something that's been basically there and many people have been in love with is the fact that everything out there is a workaround by someone that would like to solve their own personal problems.
Yeah.
It's funny that we should be on this topic, because I happen to have a proposal into the NSA to do exactly this, to build a general toolkit for agent-based systems to help model the robustness of infrastructure. And we're meeting with the NSA for our third meeting on Thursday next week.
Why did you choose macro financial crisis modeling as your application domain?
I've been to this movie that you're the finance department that wants a general ledger. You know, somebody over here
right.
wants a sales order management system. This other guy over here wants an R&D system. You know,
Right.
They need to get what's general amongst all of those, and just
it seems to me that that if any one discipline tries to do it on their own, it's too expensive to do right.
That's right.
But if they all share the cost of doing it, yeah, then we're going to get a much better result. So the question is, how do we coordinate?
I mean, there are lots of things out there. There's a toolkit, there's Repass, there's Swarm. There's lots of things that people have tried to do this with, and I think with very much your intent. And, you know, when we tried to use that, we discovered, oh, we have to write the code in C because we need to run fast, and we just couldn't get there from there. Okay. But I'm just, I mean, Lee, you must have experience with
Repass.
Well, Repass, or, I mean, do you think what... I mean, I think it's a very laudable goal, but I guess the question is it really a feasible goal? Is it really going to work?
I like the toolkits that are built on a good basic general programming language, because then you can get the power. You don't have to rely on just the toolkit. Mm-hmm. You can go up beyond it. But I think we still need more speed for the optimal power flow problem, and we need to call in some C++ routines. And so that's what I'm trying to say, that 5 years ago, they weren't there. Now we've got interfaces, so I'm hopeful that we won't really have to worry so much about all being in one venue that we can actually, and then there's something called FIPA. Have you heard about this protocol for agent-based modeling called FIPA? FIPA, I have to look at what the acronym stands for exactly, but it's being produced within the IEEE for helping all the modelers with agent-based modeling to have programs that communicate with each other using a common agent communication language protocol, and so forth.
As it's getting relatively technical, let me suggest that we all come back in about 20 minutes for the next session. Thank you again for a very stimulating talk.